Unless you know someone directly involved, everything you know about the April 15th Boston Marathon bombings came from the news media. How has the media been doing in covering this fast-breaking story? Well, at the onset, there were reports giving inflated figures for the number of people killed and the release of names of suspects who turned out not to be suspects. Then there was a day of nonstop news coverage of the manhunt for bombing suspect Jahar Zainieff. Now that he's in custody, the media is full of discussion of why the bombing happened, how it was done, who's to blame for failing to prevent it, and how it reflects on everything from immigration to welfare. What's really going on, and in what context? I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we'll turn to University of Illinois journalism professor Brant Houston and Bob Garfield of Public Radio's On the Media for their thoughts on the media's handling of this story. Your thoughts are welcome, too, today on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. And we a few minutes ago during our 10 a.m. broadcast, if you're listening at 10 a.m. live on WILL, we heard President Obama answering questions about accusations of America's intelligence readiness in light of the Boston Marathon bombing. Just one of many little headlines that have been moving across throughout the days on this story. Just taking a look at the Associated Press broadcast wire from yesterday, you'll find reports that investigators were giving more attention to the mother of the Zainieff brothers after federal officials say the Russians intercepted her phone calls and heard vague discussions of a jihad, and that Republican Congressman Peter King says Russia didn't do enough to tell the U.S. about the potential danger of the older Zainieff brother, Tamerlane Zainieff, that FBI agents left the Rhode Island home of the in-laws of that older brother and carried away several bags, and that the defense team representing surviving brother Jahar Zainieff has hired Judy Clark, an attorney with a track record of getting clients life sentences instead of the death penalty. And also a new report coming in last night that female DNA had been found on some of the wreckage from the bombs from the Boston Marathon bombing, leading to speculation that there might be another accomplice. That's just one news cycle. If 24 hours is still short enough for a news cycle, and that's part of the drumbeat of Boston Marathon bombing stories that you'll be hearing about for the next several weeks of months. Do these stories add up to revealing our useful information? Are we missing something, even a lot of things? Well, our guests on Focus today get a chance at these and other questions about the Boston Marathon bombings. With me here in the studio is Brant Houston, the Knight Chair Professor in Investigative and Enterprise Reporting at the University of Illinois. And prior to his academic career, Professor Houston was an award-winning investigative newspaper reporter for 17 years. He was on Focus last October talking to previous host Craig Cohen about investigative journalism. And Brant, welcome back to Focus.
Thanks very much.
And Bob Garfield, the co-host of NPR's On the Media. It's heard Sundays at noon here on AM 580 as our other guest today. Bob also writes about the media for The Guardian and Media Post, and he's co-host, at least that I hope that's still running, the podcast Lexicon Valley at Slate.com. Bob, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we've been on hiatus at Lexicon Valley, but it's coming back soon.
Okay, well, good to have both of you here today. Yeah, I don't know where to start on this. For a week, the Boston Marathon bombing was a very fast-moving story. And, you know, a bombing on Monday, and then a few days later, the surviving suspect captured after this tremendous police dragnet, and there was heavy coverage from all sorts of news media, from traditional outlets to social media, putting it all together. If I could start with you, Brant, how well was the public served by the news media during that week?
Well, there were a lot of stumbles that have been well publicized because as journalists, I always say we're cannibals and eat our own whenever we make mistakes. But there was a lot of terrific reporting, particularly in the where it was known as traditional and legacy media. That would be the New York Times and Boston Globe. There's some great reporting. The pressures of 24/7 cycles, though, really showed up with CNN at its worst in saying a suspect had been captured when a suspect had not been captured, continuing a sort of list of problems. it's gone on for some time in terms of reporting too quickly with too few sources.
Bob, what do you see from your monitoring of the media coverage and during that first week?
Well, I think the newspapers, by and large, did very well, and predictably, the cable news channels, you got to put quotation marks around news, they did terribly. It was a fast-breaking story in some respects, but not so fast-breaking that it accommodated the demands of 24-hour cable TV, and they made all of the mistakes that they always make in circumstances such as these, and some of them were whoppers.
You know, I'm just wondering, in any competitive news environment, is that even avoidable? If we had gone back, say, 100 years when newspapers put out, several editions a day and even extra editions, if we were looking at, say, I don't know, Pulitzer and Hearst, and they were confronting a story like this, would they have gone to the same excesses?
Probably, but we're not 100 years ago. Those were the days of very sensational yellow journalism, and the standards were different. The public's acceptance was different, and we're supposed to be in a modern era of journalism that looks askance at reporting as haphazardly as cable news did. And while it's true that Twitter and other platforms have put a lot added to the competitive pressure, the fact is that it's very easy not to make the mistakes cable made. I apologize for the ringing phone in the background. There's nothing I can do about that. it's very easy not to make those mistakes. You simply say no. You just follow journalistic canon and don't report what you haven't got officially from an official source.
I completely agree. And CNN did do me a tremendous favor for one of my classes. As it started, an advanced reporting class, they reported a suspect had been captured. And so we were able to watch in real time as they slowly retracted it, as it went viral and so forth. And the first thing I said to the class was, do you really believe this? It's based on one unnamed source. I wouldn't go with the story. And I think what's happened with CNN and some of the others is they've completely lost the basic standards of being credible. The other part is that it doesn't matter as much being first now. Quite often the social media is first. And so in the new journalism, you want to be best and you want to be right. And they seem not to understand that at all.
Well, we're talking about the news coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing here on Focus. And we welcome you to the conversation as well. If you want to join us on the air, give a call to 333-9455 or call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. You can also email your questions and comments at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Social media, which I just referenced there, played a role in the coverage here. Some of it perhaps constructive and some of it not. What would you say to that, Brent?
Well, I would say that there are a couple of things going on. One, social media can be an incredibly valuable in terms of spot news, but we still have to figure out whether it's credible, it's true or not. So it has a great value there. But I have to say I've had some colleagues and I have people in the social media who still believe in publish first, then filter. And I think we're seeing the damaging aspects of that over and over again. So I hope there will be some lessons learned during this whole sort of recounting of what happened and what was wrong.
How are you, Brent, how are you discussing this story with your students? If you're approaching this story, especially now that things have slowed down somewhat, as an investigative reporter, what would you want to find out and where would you start?
Well, As I said, I was fortunate to have classes going on during this so we could talk about what kind of investigative reporting would be done. And naturally, you would start to dig into why, what was the background of the people. Most of all, we want to know why and not to forget or forgive, but to understand what has happened here, why it's happened. And also, it came up right away, how's our intelligence, how our intelligence forces doing in all of this?
Bob, I'm wondering, and you're just following this story, Besides the sort of went on too quick with sketchy information gaffes, are there other things that the media is getting right or wrong? Are they just aren't in the ballpark? Are there maybe assumptions made that you're wondering about? Are subjects that aren't getting the proper attention?
Oh, well, let's focus on what went wrong, shall we? I mean, as a practitioner in the finding fault with others industry, I'm so loath to give credit where credit is due. So many just Bush League mistakes. You made reference to John King confirming the CNN exclusive that two men were about to be arrested, and it in the end there was an attempt to arrest two men, but there's no evidence that what he was saying 24 hours earlier had anything to do with the Tsarnaev brothers. He just had it wrong. The FBI was obliged to say, no, we're not about to arrest two people. We don't know who the culprits are. And do me a favor, CNN, shut up. I mean, that was the essence of their statement. There was this endless replay, again, predictable, but nonetheless disturbing, of the video of the bomb explosions going off in Boston, which, the video did after 9/11, it essentially denuded the event of the horror that we should feel when we see something like that. They turned it into a logo, which does a disservice to the event, and I think ultimately does a disservice to viewers. It's the cartoonization or the gifization of genuine tragedy. And once I saw that video the first time, I knew I was going to see it 1,000 more times. There was this endless rush to report latest developments because you're on the air 24/7, so you got to keep talking 24/7. And this led to filling the airwaves with simple blather, lots of repetition of wrong reporting, and just a lot of mindless stuff that looked urgent because it was being said urgently, but was ultimately just filler. And if you got nothing to say, say nothing. Move on to, regular programming and come back when you have actual news. I know viewers tune to cable news in the midst of an emergency. It's the one time when they actually get ratings. But that you're doing nobody any good to stay on the air to deliver nothing or worse than nothing. Now, and then finally, there was the use of the police scanner to report breaking maybe news, which journalistic ethics clearly prohibits. You can't do that because when there's someone at large, they could be listening to the very same police. They could be getting news about police activities and tactics. In this way, the news channels are helping the suspect remain at large. Another worst practice that we saw again and again.
Bob, I just wanted to add the sin of omission, since we're piling on now. What was really troubling to me was to see the assignment for Drew Griffin, who is an award-winning investigative reporter at CNN, which is seemingly abandoning investigative reporting. It appeared to me that Drew's assignment was to stand on a corner in Watertown and listen for the sounds of bullets being fired. I think that's one of the worst moments for me looking at it. I'm sort of used to the other errors, but that one was pretty bad, a misuse of resources. And something that was parodied by The Daily Show January was what CNN's done to investigative reporting. I really think it's time for them to revamp.
And all reporting, by the way, they have very few reporters and news gathering producers at CNN. They got a few anchors and a lot of bookers to get pundits on the air, but they don't have a very robust news organization, and nor do the other news channels. And they're destined to fail whenever the real news breaks.
Let me go ahead and say hello to a caller. Stephen Champagne is on line 4, and good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. I am I'm of a certain age where I can remember, I believe it was the Reagan attempted assassination. And at that time, there was a reporter at the news desk, Frank Reynolds with ABC, and he actually, I don't want to say flipped out, but he famously said, get it right, as the stories were coming in fast and furious. And, of course, that was close to 30 years ago. I do think that Twitter and all that does provide instantaneous information, but it's a double-edged sword where if there's no filter, obviously in cases of the Boston bombing, there was no filter. You know, the stories just come in, they may go on the air, and they may not have any basis in fact. I also think that with video, as your guest pointed out, the video is the eye candy. So we're gonna play that video, you know, till hell won't have it, over and over again. And you know, people do get desensitized by that. But it's like the 800-pound gorilla in the room. You know, you have to keep constantly feeding the TV set with pictures. You know, whether or not it had anything to do with the story or the substantive fact, you know, almost seems second nature. But the quick question I have, and I'll ring off, is I'm wondering if your guest thinks in the future, with Twitter and all that, if somehow that information can be, I don't want to say corralled or harnessed, but I think it's extremely dangerous that this information comes in so quickly and goes on the air with very little substantive reporting or fact-checking. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. And maybe if one of you wanted to take on that question about social media, actually I was thinking of this situation with, I believe it was Reddit, in which in which contributors were essentially trying to focus on suspects and do their own sleuthing in the case, and coming up so wrong that Reddit eventually issued an apology.
Yeah, crowdsourcing is a fantastic new tool that social media have created for us. In the past, I'm thinking of the U.S. attorney scandal when Alberto Gonzalez was the attorney general. Josh Marshall got his talking points memo audience working on a document dump of emails from the White House, and demonstrated to a fairly well that the White House had improperly used political pressure in the firing of some U.S. attorneys. So, you know, chalk that one up for crowdsourcing. Reddit was all of the Reddit users deputized to locate the suspect by looking at lots and lots of video, and they crowdsourced it, but they crowdsourced it wrong. And whether you're an individual news organization or a single person or a crowd of Reddit users, there's just an obligation not to report what you don't know for certain. And when I say certain, I don't mean our best guess, and I don't mean because someone in uniform told me so. You know, there's a lot of every police reporter knows that some of the least reliable information you get is from cops and paramedics and firefighters. Unless it's official, it ain't official. And the crowd is no better able to ferret out the truth than an individual eyewitness. So, good news, bad news with social media, and the further bad news, and I'll make this brief, is that seldom in history has there been a worse, a fulminating combination than cable news and Twitter. It is a vicious cycle of the worst kind, because bad information just shoots around the world before the truth can get on its pants, and we see it again and again. The Texas massacre of children found in a shallow grave was a perfect example. It was on TV in Australia before people figured out that there were no children, there was no grave, there was no massacre. It was just one irresponsible sheriff saying one thing to an irresponsible reporter who irresponsibly treated it, and it was the bad story was off and running.
Well, One thing that is occurring to me, that the Boston Marathon bombings had the dramatic effect of being the first big attack on a notable public place, in this case the finish line of a famous marathon, since the 9/11 attacks, even something like the Ricin letters that were sent to the White House and other public officials at about the same time, they're not as dramatic as something like this sort of attack. Do we pay undue attention to something like marathon bombings because they are so dramatic.
Well, if it bleeds, it leads. That's never changed. Now, you know, I'm not going to criticize the news organizations for focusing on the marathon bombings. Yes, there was police tape. Yes, there were body bags. Yes, there was chaos, which don't necessarily have a larger significance. You know, the problem with It Bleeds, It Leads is that a lot of attention is paid to crimes and tragedies that have no larger significance outside of the particulars. But in this case, there are many unanswered questions. Was it part of a conspiracy? Were similar episodes going to happen elsewhere in the country? Was it domestic? Was it lone wolf Islamists? Was it Al-Qaeda? You know, who knew? And these were questions that were on everybody's mind and had to be answered. So I don't fault them for heavy coverage. I just fault them for the quality.
Well, one thing I wanted to say about this was I think the general public has finally gotten a good idea how hard it is to do good journalism. We deal with rumors all the time, and now with social media, you can see what the challenge is. And it also really shows the need for a good journalist. But one other thing I wanted to say is I think the public is getting more sophisticated about sorting through these things and realizing they're are mistakes being made and judging them pretty quickly and moving on. A number of polls after this actually found a lot of the public, I think up to 70% in some polls, that thought the coverage was good. So I think it's good for us to berate ourselves on this, but I don't want to underestimate our audience and their ability to see through the rumors, the social media, and the sloppy reporting, especially on the 24/7 cable stations.
And it sounds like we're talking about one problem that the cable channels have is they're just not well-staffed in terms of reporters. I'm not talking about the caliber of people, but just the number of people. They don't have many people out there.
Yeah, I think they've decided to go to entertainment. There's actually still a significant difference between CNN here in the U.S. and CNN International. I travel overseas fairly often, and CNN International, it's like a totally different channel. I think we've given in to the entertainment sector, and I'm thinking that what we're seeing now is a reduction of quality is going to end up in a reduction of audience and consumers for them. I'm hoping that CNN will reexamine its business practices.
Well, how is that working out for the other two major news channels, and which also don't have as heavy reporting staffs as you might like?
Well, Fox actually got good reviews on a couple of the polls because it has an audience that believes whatever it says. So, I think we've got problems in all the 24/7. MSNBC did not report the capture, but their viewership is so much lower that they're not registering on the polls quite as often.
Now, NPR was also, for instance, on all day with live coverage during the final day of the manhunt. Bob, did you follow any of their coverage? Did they commit some of the same sins as the cable news channels?
They were very, very cautious. I listened to Steve Inskeep hosting for quite a while. And he was pretty phenomenal. I mean, he kept a level head. He was very cautious about reporting unconfirmed rumors, and was as glib and smooth and in command as, for example, Jake Tapper wasn't when he was on a street corner in Watertown or wherever, just sputtering through the live reporting. So I didn't listen to enough NPR to make any overall conclusions, but what I heard was pretty impressive.
Well, fortunately, that's the network we air here on WYLL. I don't want to be too self-serving about it, but it was nice to have them with us during that day. It's time for a short break. We'll be back with more about coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, back on Focus on WILL. My guests today are talking about media coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing. The University of Illinois journalism professor Brant Houston, and Bob Garfield of NPR's On the Media, which is heard Sundays at noon here on WILL. And we welcome your questions and comments. You can call us at 333-9455, toll-free at 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. As Deborah did, she had a question that Bob Garfield, I believe, you touched on a little bit, and that's under the use of unnamed sources. Deborah writes, it seems that nearly everything that's come out about the investigation, says Jacquard's capture, has come from unnamed sources. How seriously should these unnamed sources be taken, and why do you think there are so many leaks?
Well, it's not just this story. The attribution to unnamed sources is a pestilence throughout journalism, especially with coverage from Washington. And the fact is, there is no way to evaluate the reliability of those reports. All you know is that the reporter passing them along believes them, and that's the best you've got. And so if you read between the lines, you can sometimes figure out, you know, maybe the level of the official who, for whatever reason, has chosen not to be quoted. But, you know, you just don't know whether it's someone in uniform passing on bad information. As we see so often in breaking news stories of crimes and hurricanes and plane crashes, it's unanswerable, really. If you read, I guess my anonymous source DAR is pretty good. I can often figure out who is really being quoted, but if they're not willing to put their name to it, you don't even know whether they're assured of what they're saying to the reporter. It's a bad practice, and it very, very seldom serves the public.
I guess the most famous anonymous source I can think of is Woodward and Bernstein's Washington Post coverage of Watergate and the so-called Deep Throat source. And I forget exactly who it was. I believe it was a high-up, someone relatively high-up.
Mark Felt.
Thank you very much.
Mark Felt. He was number two at the FBI at the time.
Now, would that be an example of also dicey use of an unnamed source, or was that source used responsibly, maybe checked up on?
They didn't use it much as a source. There was almost nothing in their reporting that attributed an allegation or an assertion to him. They were using him principally for direction and to confirm stuff they'd heard elsewhere. You know, I would think pretty much that was the highest and best use, if you don't count WikiLeaks actually, WikiLeaks is not relevant here. I apologize. I instruct the jury to ignore that statement. But it may be the highest and best use of an unnamed source and that journalistic history has to offer. You know, sometimes when the stakes are very high, you have to do what you have to do. But now they are used, anonymous sources are used when the stakes are low as a routine business as usual in journalistic coverage, and it's a shabby kind of reporting.
Yeah, I agree with Bob. It's used too much. It's prevalent. But I also want to note that there's some guidelines for the use on this. And, you know, when you think someone may die from revealing themselves and giving you really good information, that would be a good time to have an anonymous source, or injury or major damage to their career. But you have to measure all that. But I go back to the beginning of our discussion, which is the important thing is to multi-source. And if you're using anonymous sources at all, you've got to have high standards for it, and you've got to multi-source, unless you've got an authentic document the source has given to you. So there are some guidelines for it, but I agree, Washington, D.C. has been out of control on this for some time. And it really shows the balance of power is too much with the officials and not with the journalist.
In a sense that this is an opportunity for officials to spin without having to take the heat.
Yeah, and that and to get back to law enforcement is very competitive. I've covered quite a bit of law enforcement, and you really, really have to measure the leaks there in terms of who's being used, which arena is being represented and what they're wanting to leak to you. I think the Clinton investigations, Clinton Lewinsky, were a real low point for journalism. It was so clear, I'm sure, to Bob, too, who was using whom during that. That era.
Okay. You know, one thing I'm wondering, now that there is somebody in custody, there is another angle of the investigation, and now we're seeing more about the context of these attacks, or at least people trying to put these attacks in context. Has any of that been useful, and has any of it not been useful?
I think the New York Times has done some great on-the-ground reporting, and I really commend them for it over the last couple of weeks by having still having a good reporting staff, a great reporting staff, and reporting out of Russia and the former Soviet Union and the U.S. I think we're starting to get some very decent context for why this happened, or at least why this was intended to happen by the perpetrators.
What are you seeing, Bob, along those lines?
I think the reporting has been good by major newspapers, which, as Brian said, do have resources still to do what journalists do. There was a story in the New York Times that tried to get into the head of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the suspect who was killed in the midst of the manhunt. And on the same day, with almost an identical headline and placement in the Washington Post, a similar story that led to similar conclusions about his disaffection with the American society that at one point he tried very much to be a part of. It was pretty compelling, and relied on testimony that people put their names to. So you know that's always a helpful sign. You know, it may be that 70% of the people who watch this stuff approved when asked a poll question about it. But I got to tell you, these things are aggregatable. They distrust forms by accretion. And every time you get one thing wrong in even the most innocuous story, the principals know that it's wrong. I had a city editor at one point who was, believe me, no I.F. Stone, but he was crazy about middle initials. We had to have middle initials, and if you got it wrong, God help you, because whoever read, when the principal read the paper the next day, you know, he or she knew that you got the middle initial wrong, which forever colored their view of the press. And this stuff adds up, and you have a responsibility to get everything right all the time. And being haphazard, lazy, cautious, in the long run, redounds to the detriment of journalistic trust. And if you ask people a different poll question, do you believe what you read in the newspaper, the answer will be a resounding no.
That they don't believe what they read in the newspaper as compared to other media.
Yeah, never mind cable news, never mind Twitter. People, you know, and then this, of course, breaks down along political lines as well. People believe all sorts of things about the press, including jumping to conclusions about political agendas and so forth. But the American public is pretty uniform in distrusting the content that they're reading or seeing or
and
hearing.
And is that different from, say, 20, 40, 60 years ago?
Well, I don't have the numbers in front of me, Brent, but I believe they go downhill pretty spectacularly since the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah, I think they've been going down for some time. There was never a golden era of news, but there certainly were higher standards. And I'm happy about the fact that Americans have a love-hate relationship with their media. I think that's really good. We're supposed to be skeptical, and they're supposed to be skeptical of us. But I would say at a certain point, we're probably going to have a correlation of the reduction of resources, staff, and standards matching the increasing distrust of the media. And I think it's a real call to get back to to some kind of quality. I think we've lost, 20,000 reporters and editors out of 60,000 in the last decade in print. You can't go into any industry and have that many layoffs and cutbacks and not have a deep diminishing of quality.
Deborah, who had emailed earlier, followed up with a comment, and I've heard this in other contexts. As I listened to coverage of the hunt for the Tsarnaevs, I wondered if the constant attention would encourage future homegrown terrorists, as similar coverage may have encouraged school shooters. What do you think about that? One thing comes to mind that in terms of school shooters, many of whom may be suicidal, I have heard concerns raised by psychologists in that particular context, psychologists who treat those cases as essentially suicides, who also kill a lot of people. I don't know if that comes into cases like that, but should that be a concern in how these violent attacks are covered?
I don't think you can make a decision about worrying about copycats or worrying about people who want to commit suicide by cop, or even worry about people who just want to see their face in the paper no matter what. This has always been an issue for journalism. Perhaps it's been a greater issue since we lost any sense of shame in our society. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a day when perpetrators put their raincoats over their heads so they wouldn't be their faces wouldn't be in the newspaper the next day. And now an arrest is I won't say universally, but frequently a badge of honor. It's a way to be famous. Notoriety and infamy no longer seem to be a part of the equation. It's just fame. And as a consequence, there's greater likelihood of egging on other people to commit crimes just to make something of themselves. But that can't be the responsibility of journalism. We have to talk about what's happening and not to glorify criminal acts, but we sure got to cover them.
Right. In defense of journalism, I can't think of something recent in the U.S. in which anyone, and I can't think of much, of which somebody was glorified for doing what these guys did or any terrorists beforehand. I think we can maintain that we're not glorifying them, but it's going to be very difficult not to report about a bombing or a shooting, especially when it's ongoing and the public wants to know what's going on. I actually have two friends in Boston who wish there had been more coverage because they were coming back from Logan Airport into Watertown about the time the shootout was going on, and they would have been very pleased to have even more, to the second kind of coverage.
Hmm. Let me go ahead to another caller. This is our second Steve of the day on line one. This Steve is calling from Springfield, Missouri. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call. I'm a former Urbana resident. Just can't leave Focus alone. I really appreciate the comments being made about the unnamed sources. I think that is the biggest bane in our media coverage right now. And, of course, if I don't have to name the sources, then I can make up whatever I want. And I think that's a lot of what has happened lately. The other thing that I wanted to raise, I think that there was a golden age of certainly television reporting. I think that Chet Huntley and David Brinkley and Walter Cronkite were the people that a great deal of America trusted at one time. And now I wouldn't trust what I hear on maybe CNN, but the rest of them, I wouldn't trust it any further than I could compost it. So I appreciate the balanced conversation, and I'll hang up and listen online.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. And well, kudos to you two for pointing that out. But is it anything that's going to go away? The use of unnamed sources to the further stories without any particular backup or confirmation.
I think it depends on the part of what is now a very fractured media. I think there has been a backing up at some of the what's known as the mainstream or the traditional press on less a use. But it's always going to be a temptation. And I do want to say one thing. In my experience, there are very few reporters who have made anything up. It's when it comes to getting information from anonymous sources, I think it's them not being skeptical enough and not being strict enough with their own reporting and having the standards high enough. One thing I don't think the public always realizes is how much good journalists ignore and how much bad information they get all the time. So I think the anonymous sources, unfortunately, leads, you know, as Bob has said, leads down a pretty perilous road.
On the other hand, I should say that the extraordinary reporting from the New York Times, for example, of illegal renditions, of secret prisons, of National Security Agency wiretaps of Americans, of all sorts of state security kind of horrors of the past 15 years, never would have seen the light of day without anonymous sources. So, you know, there are places where it's necessary, but unfortunately it's just become routine. And that's not a good routine. Not because reporters are making stuff up. The handful of reporters who have invented things have been drummed out of the core, but because we have no way to evaluate the motivations of the people they're quoting, whether it's political, whether it's careerist, whether it's diplomatic. We don't know. And as a consequence, we have no way to judge whether we're getting the straight dope. There's the problem. Sometimes we need to have anonymous sources, but we certainly don't need to have it be a daily occurrence.
And there's one last thing to add on that. The New York Times did push and has pushed, and has have other newspapers, to explain, if at all possible, why they're having to use an anonymous source. That was a big leap forward a few years ago, actually. Giving us some measure of judgment on what was going on.
Still time for your questions here on Focus about the media's coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings. We're talking with Bob Garfield of NPR's On the Media and journalism professor Brant Houston of the University of Illinois. And I'm wondering, with mistakes made in spurious reports getting on the air, Do you feel that there are public misperceptions that linger in this story, even after the corrections have been made?
I'm sure there are. I mean, there's a lot of Americans who believe that Obama is a Muslim and was born in Kenya or something. So we cannot necessarily take responsibility for people retaining information that has been that has been misreported and then corrected, but the corrections haven't really gotten through to the audience. As you said, I think in your intro, there is some nature in a very fast-moving news cycle. There's a self-correcting aspect of it. This is one of the great arguments for Twitter. A lot of spurious reporting goes on there, but it's quickly caught by the community and fixed. The problem is, if you're not there, if you hear the false report and you're not there for the quick correction, you're just as misinformed as you were to begin with. So, sure, there's a lot of people out there who think that, no doubt, that the Tsarnaevs were, Arabs, who think that they are part of an Al-Qaeda-led conspiracy, who think that there were part of who knows what they think. There was a lot of bad stuff out there, but the corrections have long since been made, and can't do anything about the retaining the bad info. It's a good argument though for not passing on bad stuff to begin with.
Well, I guess one example of And of course, he would beg to differ, but the reports coming out on the Blaze, Glenn Beck's website, promoting a theory that a Saudi national who was earlier named as a person of interest actually helped the Boston bombing suspects, the Saneyev brothers, execute the explosions. The Blaze has been pushing this hard and essentially sending out statements asking government leaders to find answers for it. It has factoids connected to it. I suppose we don't know at this point whether or not the Zanayev brothers actually had anybody else working with them, and it really is a question mark. But
it may be. But anybody who listens to Glenn Beck or similar demagogues and similar, you know, reactionary loudmouths deserves the bad information they're getting. They are in the entertainment business too, and they entertain a demographic of conspiracy theorists and fringe reactionaries, and they deserve one another.
Yeah, we need a category in news called P.T. Barnum, and sort of a Roger Ebert thumbs up, thumbs down when it comes to asking questions in order to cause rumors. It's not in the news business, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Have there ever been situations when the rumor mongers have stumbled upon something right that that more responsible parts of the media had not found?
The only thing I can think of, the only example, is the right-wing blogosphere figured out before the rest of the world that CBS News had probably gotten a hold of a forged document connecting then President George W. Bush to bad behavior when he was in the I think it was the Army Reserve,
the Guard, yeah, yeah,
National Guard, Air National Guard, yeah, and you know, that was a big shame because while they were right in the, probably right in the reporting, it took everybody's attention off the larger part of the story, which is that the president had in fact gotten special treatment, but it was a huge omelet in the face of CBS News. People lost their jobs over it, including Rather, and that was I think was uncovered by a blog called GreenFootballs.com.
Little Green Footballs, so
they have some hits, but for every hit, there's a Brazilian politically inflected misses.
It's interesting. If we look at Little Green Footballs, the blog now, they don't look as right-wing as they did back then in terms of their political pronouncements.
And I want to say from a journalist standpoint, it's amazing what people with certain views can be right on. So as a reporter, you listen to all of it. But, you know, we've moved into this area of where, as Bob had said, there's entertainment, it's rumor mongering and so forth. But as a reporter, I still remember people forget about Watergate. The Washington Post was out on its own for quite some time. And it was, you know, I think they were considered conspiracy theorists way back at that point. So you take everything in, and one of the sayings we had in the newsroom is a broken clock is right twice a day. So you measure everything as it comes in.
By the way, I must say, I'm not trying to impugn the journalist integrity of Little Green Footballs. I don't consider that particular blog to be out there, you know, among the John Birchers. I think they've done some very recent stuff, and I don't put them on the fringe in any way, shape, or form. Others, the Glenn Beckosphere, I certainly do.
Okay. This may have to be my last question. I'm wondering, the Zanayev family are ethnic Chechens, even if they didn't exactly come from Chechnya. How has that context been covered? Are there things that reporters may have to catch up on as far as the whole back politics of the Chechen conflict and really trying to understand what happened in this attack?
Well, I think the answer to that question is yes. We haven't gotten enough on that. What was reported very little was that had there been a connection to Chechen terrorism, that is two of the most horrific terrorist incidents of the last 10 years were perpetrated by the Chechen militant movement, if you can call it that. And they, I mean, there was a horrible takeover of a school in which many children were killed, and there was the takeover of the of a theater in Moscow showing mm-hmm. a play called East West, if I recall correctly, in which it was a bloodbath, and it would be very scary to think that their attentions had turned westward. Now there was no evidence of that there being any sort of connection that's been developed yet, but that was certainly one of the things foremost in my mind when the Tsarnaevs were identified, and I saw very little on it.
Well, we're going to have to just break it off there. I'm so sorry we're out of time, but my thanks to both of you on being on Focus today for your insights on the media's handling of the Boston Marathon bombings. Bob Garfield of NPR's On the Media, you can hear it Sundays at noon on WILL AM 580. Onthemedia.org is their website, and University of Illinois Journalism Professor Houston Brandt. Welcome any additional thoughts that you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Tomorrow on Focus, how big is a nanometer? Not very big at all, but you need it to measure the size of things used in nanotechnology, which we'll be talking about with two experts from the University of Illinois on tomorrow's show. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows.